This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the program, the Vietnam Veterans Movement. Journalist Gerald Nicosia is our guest. Nicosia is the author of the new book, Home to War, A History of the Vietnam Veterans Movement. The book tells the story of the battles veterans fought after they returned home from Southeast Asia. It's a comprehensive history. It documents the social and political issues the vets struggled with after their service. They protested the war. They fought for better medical treatment and compensation for injuries caused by Agent Orange, while the government sought to stymie their efforts. Gerald Nicosia did not serve. He opposed the war, but he has tremendous respect for the men who did. Over the course of a dozen years, he conducted hundreds of interviews for Home to War. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. Join the discussion with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. Our number is 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Gerald Nicosia has been a freelance journalist, interviewer, and literary critic for 25 years. His work has appeared in hundreds of publications. In addition to Home to War, Nicosia is the author of Memory Babe, a critical biography of Jack Kerouac. A graduate of the University of Illinois Chicago, he has taught there as well as at UCLA. Again, those telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Gerald Nicosia, good afternoon. Welcome.
Welcome. I mean, glad to be here.
How was it that you became so taken with the veterans of this war and their stories?
Well, the whole thing is I'm part of that generation. I mean, I grew up in the 60s, came of age in the 60s, believed, you know, growing up outside of Chicago, very patriotic area, Pledge of Allegiance every day, believed that I lived in the best country on earth, was told that over and over again, that we only did righteous things. John F. Kennedy was president when I became a teenager, you know, saying we were very idealistic. We will bear any burden, pay any price to make this a democratic world. So, you know, I think all of us at that point believed that, and we heard stories of World War II and that our fathers had fought the good fight to get rid of fascism in the world, and you know, we watched the movies growing up, Sands of Iwo Jima and John Wayne, and, you know, the war against the Japs and the Germans, the bad guys of the world. And we, you know, Americans always, we put down the bad guys and we did the good things. And then this war came along that really threw my whole generation for a loop. You know, in the mid-60s, we started hearing about Vietnam, a draft. We've got to go, the young men have to go and fight, kill communists in Vietnam, and it didn't make any sense to us because we hadn't heard anything that Vietnam had ever done against our country. Most of us couldn't even find Vietnam on a map, and it was a very disturbing thing because, you know, we were hearing from everybody, from teachers and mayors and our parents, and I was raised a Catholic. Even the priests were saying we should go to this war. It's a moral cause. It's a good cause. And I think most of us, you know, had a lot of disquiet, a lot of discomfort about, like, well, why do we have to go there? You know, what's the real reason to go? And we're not rushing off to lots of other communist countries in Eastern Europe and killing people just because they're communists. So it was a very disturbing and troubling thing. And I guess I was lucky. I was reading some documents of Christian pacifism. I was reading Henry David Thoreau's Civil Disobedience, and I was able to, you know, feel that I had the moral right to oppose the war. But, you know, lots of other working-class kids, just the pressure from their parents or whatever was too much, and they basically, you know, went and got there and thought they were doing something that was really good. And then they got there, and they were very, very disillusioned because they saw lots of atrocities, and they saw basically a people that did not want Americans there. And so these sacrifices seemed to be for nothing, and that was a very demoralizing thing. And so, being part of that generation, I you know, I'm sympathetic to that whole thing. I never condemned veterans. I felt that, you know, I very well might have ended up as one of them.
Hmm. To my knowledge, there has not been a history of the veterans movement until this book. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. Of course, parts of the story have come out in different memoirs and here and there, but it's a huge story. My book was actually twice as long as it's a 700-page book, as you know, and it was actually twice as long. It was cut, was canceled by three other publishers, and the only way that Random House agreed to publish it was, you know, if I cut half the book out, which I did. So it's an enormous story because it begins with these guys coming back to a country that not only didn't welcome them or recognize their sacrifice. As the World War II vets got this huge boost when they came home, the World War II vets got a great GI Bill, and these guys got a GI Bill that was almost nothing in a country that was condemning them and blaming them for the war, and in some cases spitting on them and calling them baby killers. And even the right wing, you know, they always sort of say, well, the left was unfair to the vets, but a lot of the guys on the right were not happy either. I've heard so many stories of Vietnam vets being kicked out of VFW halls and kicked out of American Legion halls. Said, well, you guys are just druggies like the rest of your generation. You were too weak to win your war. We won ours, you know. And so these guys got no respect. They got a lot of condemnation, and no way to deprogram from the horrors that they had seen. Nobody would listen to them. They couldn't talk out those problems, and that was just the beginning of things. You know, they went to the VA and they would talk about the fact that they were having flashbacks or nightmares or trouble readjusting, and the VA would say, "Oh, there's no problem here. There's nothing in the book that we can give you as a diagnosis," because indeed at that time there was no diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. Of course, and soon after that, a lot of them started developing cancers and strange health problems, and their kids were being born with birth defects, which later, you know, we came to realize was due to the Dacs, and they were exposed to an Agent Orange, a defoliant in Vietnam. And once again, the government denied that there was any possible chemical harm from that war, just as the government right now is denying any possible chemical harm from the Gulf War, and you've got 200,000 sick Gulf War veterans. But anyway, it's just a long list of things where the government repeatedly just kept turning its back. Not only was the country turning its back, then the very government that sent them to war was turning its back on them.
Benefits for veterans, they were less for Vietnam vets than for Korean vets and vets of World War II. How did that happen?
Well, you know, World War II, obviously the country was celebrating the end of the war. These guys that fought the World War II were looked upon as heroes. My old friend Studs Terkel there from Chicago wrote The Good War, you know, talking about how much feeling of praise and, you know, satisfaction the country had with its World War II vets. It gave them the best package in history, and it didn't hurt that lots of World War II vets went into Congress after the war too, so to kind of bolster their congressional support, because these guys believed in the country, they believed in the cause, they believed in government. Total opposite. Almost no Vietnam vets went into Congress after the Vietnam War. In fact, Vietnam vets to this day don't want to join anything. But anyway, you know, the World War II vets, they had a package where they could go to any university in the nation, get their tuition paid and a living stipend while they were going to school. So if they could get into Harvard or Yale, they could go there. And this was incredible. You had so many working class guys that never would have seen an Ivy League university getting Harvard education, Yale educations, Princeton educations. Now, what happened with Vietnam? Very simple. Lyndon Johnson was under tremendous pressure about fighting that war. Lots of people, even from the mid-60s on, had grave questions about the war, whether we should be committing such large amounts of troops. Remember, at one point, Johnson had over 500,000 soldiers in Vietnam, and he was taking a tremendous amount of heat for that. People said, we don't want a real war. And Johnson had to come back and say, well, it's not a real war. It's a limited action here to limit communism. I forget what they used, but, you know, just some euphemism. Well, the whole point was Johnson knew very well that if he was going to have a big GI Bill, you know, which was going to be very costly in terms of billions of dollars, well, the country was going to go nuts. You tell us it's not a war, and then we got this huge GI Bill to foot the bill for. So Johnson deliberately kept that GI Bill as low as he possibly could. When these initial Vietnam vets came back, they were getting something like $100 a month, which was just incredible. Even in the 60s, there was very, you know, that's why lots of guys went to California, actually, because the cheapest state schools were in California. So they tried to stretch their $100 a month as far as they could. But and of course, there's a whole history. Even then, the checks didn't come. Some sometimes for 6 months, guys weren't getting their checks. And even the paraplegics like Ron Kovic, guys that needed their checks to live on because, you know, they couldn't work, they're paralyzed, and their checks weren't coming. There are huge delays in the checks, and that's why Ron Kovic used to always go and take over buildings everywhere to protest the bad treatment.
Yeah, Ron Kovic being really a well-known individual, a well-known veteran, famous for Born on the 4th of July.
Right, and was subsequently became a very good friend of mine. In fact, he was one of the people who, through meeting him and meeting lots of his veteran friends, began to show me how much damage still existed from the war. And through Ron, I was really encouraged and stimulated to write the book that I did, Home to War.
Yeah. In the early 1980s, my husband and I produced a documentary called Still Coming Home after the movie Coming Home.
Uh-huh.
And our companion station, WILL-TV, recently produced a documentary telling the stories of Vietnam veterans. In both programs, it was clear that there are veterans who still very much feel the pain of the Vietnam War. How true is that of the veterans that you know?
Oh, it's tremendously true. And, you know, you get into a very delicate issue here because lots of vets feel that if you start bringing up the pain of the war, you're somehow condemning them or condemning what they did in the war. There's a guy named Jug Burkett who's got a book out, a self-published book called Stolen Valor, but it's certainly gotten a tremendous amount of attention, and he wants to say there's no such thing as post-traumatic stress, there's no such thing as even Agent Orange poisoning, that these are all things that have been conjured up to discredit the war. And he's, you know, considers himself a valiant warrior, although he was in the rear area. He actually never saw combat, but he feels that, you know, that his valor is being stolen because of people that are talking about delayed stress. But, you know, I mean, for somebody like me who's been out there in the last 20 years, you know, interviewing hundreds and not only interviewing, but becoming close friends with many, many of these people. And I can tell you the pain in their lives are real. The cancers are real. The deaths are real. A number of people that I interviewed over the last 12 or 13 years have committed suicide, are no longer with us. I apologize for that other phone ringing, but you won't hear anything beyond the ring. It should go off in a minute. Anyway, I've seen lives fall apart. I know guys that are in and out of prison. I've seen so much pain. It's not something that anybody's invented to get a VA compensation check, or nobody's invented it to discredit the war. I've lost some really good friends, as I said, through suicide and people that couldn't get their lives together, just couldn't make a job work, couldn't make a relationship work, had too many flashbacks, nightmares, pain, psychotic breaks from the war. So those things are real. Now, does that mean that all vets are like that? Obviously not. And obviously many vets have led very productive lives. But the point that I try to make in my book is that doesn't mean that there's not pain with them from the war, you know, because a guy's got he's a businessman, you know, he's holding down a job or he's got a family. But if you ask a lot of those guys questions, say, but do you still remember the war? They'll usually, every day, some of them say, yes, every day. Do you still wake up at night sometimes with nightmares? Yes, I do. So obviously people like Ron Kovic or Senator John Kerry, you know, they've been able to lead very distinguished lives. But, you know, for example, I know, you know, knowing Ron personally, who's somebody who's been a close friend for almost 20 years, does Ron Kovic sometimes have nights where he absolutely can't sleep at all, even today? Yes, yes, ma'am, he does. So that's the issue, I think. Well, nobody's trying to discredit or nobody's trying to say that Vietnam vets can't turn it around, because so many of them have turned it around. So many of them have used their knowledge of hurt and pain to help other people. Many of them have become psychologists, have become pioneers in post-traumatic stress theory. Others have taken up the issue of chemical toxins like dioxin and have worked on those issues. Many of them are using their experience indeed to help others, but it doesn't mean that they haven't paid a huge price, and that maybe they still pay a psychological price.
Do you think since the war's end, from then until today, that the image of the Vietnam veteran has changed?
Oh, yes, it has. There's no question. And the movies had something to do with that, and the movies, even Coming Home, the movie you mentioned, which was actually loosely based on Ron Kovic, long before his own movie, Born on the 4th of July, was made. He was working closely with Jane Fonda on that movie, Coming Home. Many of those movies began to give more dignity, and TV movies and so on. Some really good documentaries like Dear America, The Letters Home. All of those things began to give the public a better knowledge of why these guys were troubled, because it was too easy. Early on, there was just kind of a stereotype that, you know, they were crazed from Vietnam, or they're drug addicts, or they're violent. That was probably the worst stereotype, that they were violent, because the truth is that most of these people that I've talked to have all said to me, we saw so much violence in Vietnam and so much brutality that if anything, we want to be pacifists. We don't want to hurt anybody for the rest of our lives. And indeed, you know, there was this famous organization that I write about in my book, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, that scared Richard Nixon to death and scared a lot of the politicians, thousands of Vietnam veterans coming to Washington to protest the war and to throw their medals back. And the government, you know, anticipated violence because they thought, wow, these guys are the best trained killers in the world, because we trained them. The American military trained them. You know, we got a problem here. Thousands of them are going to come and storm the White House and storm Congress. Well, they didn't storm anything. All of their demonstrations were peaceful. I don't think in the whole 10-some-year history of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, I mean, it still exists in a very, very small form, but, you know, the actual mass organization was maybe 10 years at the most. In all that history, there was not one actual act of violence or harming anybody. And by the way, the FBI would have known about it because they surveilled these people like crazy. Through the Freedom of Information Act, I was able to get a 10-foot-high stack of surveillance documents from the FBI. And they were not only watching the Vietnam Veterans Movement, they had infiltrators, they had, agent provocateur, they had undercover moles. They were doing everything they possibly could to not only surveil, but to derail this organization.
Hmm. Gerald Nicosia is our guest this afternoon. He's a journalist. He is author of the new book, Home to War, A History of the Vietnam Veterans Movement. The book tells the story of the battles vets fought after they came home from Southeast Asia. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. The story that you tell of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War is really, really interesting. Tell us about the beginnings of this group.
Well, the movement itself began in 1967, and it was begun by a single man named Jan Barry. Actually, Jan Crum took the name of Jan Barry as a pen name. He became a writer subsequently. And the issue that was happening was that, of course, so many Vietnam veterans realized that the war was wrong because, again, as I said, they would go there and they would see that, you know, we weren't being welcomed as, you know, allies, the way the Americans, when we went through France, you know, and you had the French families coming out of their houses to embrace the Americans coming through. My God, the liberators are here, you know, and Italy, the families kissing the American troops. Well, this was not happening. If anything, not only were the Vietnamese people often, showing anger or whatever toward the Americans there, but the troops that we were supposed to be helping often wouldn't even fight. And this was a very common experience. Ask many Vietnam vets, you'll get this answer. We were sent out in the field. We were supposed to support the such and such Vietnamese unit, and when the battle came, when the bullets started coming, the Vietnamese unit took off and ran, and we were stuck there by ourselves. So it was very clear that something was amiss. And of course, sacrifice, you know, people are there, and even if it's a bad cause, well, people are dying, people are losing their arms, they're getting legs, getting paralyzed like Ron Kovic. What's going on here? We're making the ultimate sacrifice, and there's no real cause. There's a government that nobody in this country wants. Why are we propping up this government? And so they'd come home, and many of them were very sympathetic to the peace movement. And of course, from the early to... or let's say from 64 or 65 on, there was a substantial peace movement growing in the United States. But it was being discredited, and the government was trying to say, well, the peace people are just cowards, they're communist, influenced by communists. Later, when Agnew was vice president, he came up with the line, they were commie pinko fags. If you were against the war, you were a commie pinko fag. You know, you were communist or gay or coward or probably all three. And so the Vietnam vets started to talk among themselves and say, well, hey, you know, wait a minute. You know, we're not cowards. We were there, and yet we know the war is wrong. We've got to come forward and use our credibility as veterans to speak to the nation. And that's what Jan Barry did. He organized a little group in his kitchen in New York City of Vietnam veterans who were going to go out. And at first they were just like a speaker's bureau. They would speak at college campuses, and sometimes they got on some TV shows, David Susskind's show. But they weren't having much of an impact, and they realized that they had to do some dramatic actions to really get the awareness of the nation. So it wasn't until they were formed in 67, but it wasn't until 71 that they came up with the idea that really finally grabbed the nation, grabbed the world, and that's when, as I said, thousands of them went to Washington, D.C. To camp on the Mall, and then for a whole week, and then at the end of the week, throwing their medals back on the steps of Congress. And that just... That knocked everybody over, the Congress, the nation, to see these men who had the Silver Stars and Purple Hearts, and clearly many of them were wounded or crippled or whatever, and throwing their medals back and saying, this war is wrong, end it now.
Yeah. In 1969-1970, a guy by the name of Al Hubbard came into the group, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Who was he and why was he so important to the movement?
Well, Al Hubbard... was a former Black Panther. He was also a little bit older because he had been an Air Force veteran, and he had been involved in clandestine operations, which some people don't realize, but when the French were fighting to retake their colony in the 50s and we were supporting them, we were also flying clandestine military support missions with the Air Force to supplies and probably materiel and so on to the beleaguered French at Dien Bien Phu. And Al Hubbard was one of those guys who had seen that. He had been on those missions back in the 50s when basically it wasn't America versus the communist Vietnamese. It was the French versus the communist Vietnamese with America in a support role. So he knew that the war was wrong for a long time, you know, way back in the 50s. But he also had the advantage of somebody who, having been involved with the Panthers, realized the power of a grassroots political movement and realized that if you get into the street and you do in-your-face kind of demonstrations, you can move the nation. And so he changed VVAW. He was really the critical factor that got it from that Speaker's Bureau kind of thing in 67 to where it was a mass confrontational in-the-street organization in 71. And he brought in a lot more veterans, minority veterans, Black veterans, and basically radicalized the organization, and as I say, was able to make it something that it wasn't just people, you know, in suits and ties speaking on colleges. Any angry working class vet who wanted to speak back to their government could join now and could just be part of a massive demonstration, carrying the picket sign or blocking a street. They even blocked Collins Avenue in Miami Beach when Nixon was being renominated in 72. And that was Hubbard's force.
Yeah, you mentioned the rally in 71 in Washington as a turning point. Also, it seems to me that the reporting of My Lai, reported by Seymour Hersh, was also a critical turning point.
Yes, it was. You know, veterans. I mean, any GI who was over there, I think, was aware of some form of atrocity. And, of course, there's, you know, lots of debates about what do you mean by atrocity. Every vet wasn't slitting a woman's throat or an old man's throat or something. But certainly we had a policy in Vietnam called Free Fire Zone. And at one point, I think three-fourths of South Vietnam was designated a Free Fire Zone. And this was basically a genocidal policy. It was a policy which said that anything that moved or lived in that particular area could be killed, whether it was woman, baby, child, whatever. And, of course, the rationale was that we used to say we have to clear out these areas of communists. We can't seem to get rid of the communists. Well, we never asked the question, why are so many people attracted to communism in this country? But, you know, damn it, we got to clear out this area. So we'd drop little leaflets. You know, we'd say, you must be out of your village by next Saturday because we're going to come through here with the helicopters, the machine guns. And if you're still in this village, you will be designated a communist. We will kill you. Well, it didn't work. The theory didn't work because the problem was this was an ancestor-worshipping people. They buried their ancestors in the same village for thousands of years, and they did not want to move out of those villages. It was sacred to them. They would do ceremonies many times during the year to those buried ancestors, and you had to do the ceremony right where the ancestor was buried. That was part of their religion. So they'd get a little leaflet saying, well, move out or you're going to be killed. Well, lots of times they didn't move out. They, you know, this is where we've been here for thousands of years. We're staying, and then you know the helicopters or the napalm, the machine guns, come over and just annihilate the village, burn the village down, and so there was endless killing of civilians, and veterans were seeing stuff like that. They knew that was going on. It was a very troubling thing to many of them. The story didn't leak out until it was something really big, and that was the village of My Lai, where 500. Women and children were killed by William Calley's platoon of the AmeriCal division. And the story was hushed up by the American military, which quite well knew what had happened there. It was in 1968, and I believe it wasn't until March of 68, and it wasn't until November of 69 that Seymour Hersh broke the story when a really troubled GI had come to him with some of the facts and I think some of the photos as well, showing the piles of bodies of women and children. And what happened then was that the Nixon administration really panicked about, my God, they're revealing the atrocities. We've got to do something here. And so what they did is they tried to scapegoat Calley. They tried to say, well, this thing has never happened before, will never happen again. It was the product of one crazy young lieutenant named William Calley. And so many Vietnam veterans just looked at each other and said, you know, who are they trying to kid here? Maybe not 500, but we saw the killing of prisoners. We saw tortures and rapes. And they got together and they said, we've got to tell the country that. And so they had a big thing called the Winter Soldier Investigation in Detroit. Jane Fonda financed it. And hundreds of veterans came forward with their discharge forms to show their authenticity. And one after another, they testified to rape and torture and murder. And it was a very, very heavy thing, a very, very powerful thing. It's been recorded on a film that nobody will show, a film called Winter Soldier. And the woman who made it, Lucy Phoenix, lives out here in California. She says public television won't touch it. Nobody will touch it. It was shown at Stanford about a year and a half ago, and the incoming freshmen there sort of blew their minds. They had their mouths open when it was over. It's an hour-long film. It's a very heavy thing. You see these guys who are, you know, heavy-duty Marine combat veterans, and the tears are just streaming down their faces as they're talking about these horrors that they were part of.
Let's talk with a listener on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question for you. Yes. It seems to me that you just said that the Vietnamese were an ancestor-worshipping people.
Many of them were, yes.
It seems to me the predominant religions are Catholicism and Buddhism. Skipping Catholicism, would you define Buddhism as an ancestor-worshipping religion?
Well, you know, Vietnamese Buddhism is not a pure Buddhism. I mean, the ancestor worship is mixed in with it. Laili Hayslip, who wrote When Heaven and Earth Change Places, which Oliver Stone made into a movie, I've heard her speak many times, and indeed she is a Buddhist, but she's also talked about the importance of of ceremonies to the ancestors. It's not a pure, if there is such a thing as a pure Buddhism, I don't know, but it's very, very definitely mixed in with ancestor worship. I mean, where their people are buried was very, very sacred to them. It still is to many of those people. And when we would sort of take them out of a village to protect them, take them out of their native village and put them in a strategic hamlet, which was surrounded by barbed wire, it was a very traumatic experience for many of those people. In fact, it turned many of those people against America because we were doing those things.
Well, I think you could say that most people are attached to their villages and cities and their homes, but it seems to me you should be a little more careful of your statements. If you can be that wildly off on Buddhism, certainly there's great reverence for the ancestor, but I don't think any ethno-religious student would call it ancestor worship.
I'm not saying that Buddhism is ancestor-worshipping, sir. I'm saying that the people of Vietnam, to a large extent, are ancestor-worshipping people.
Gerald Nicosia is our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his book, Home to War, A History of the Vietnam Veterans Movement. Other questions and comments are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Before the caller's comments, we were talking about Winter Soldier, My Lai, and I wanted to ask you about, as a follow-up to that discussion, what are your thoughts about the story of John Kerry?
Bob Kerry, you mean?
I'm sorry, yes. Bob Kerry.
Well, I was very troubled by the attacks on Bob Kerry. You know, when he did come forward, and granted he came forward under pressure, I don't think it's a heroic thing that it took the pressure of the New York Times or whatever, some of these news agencies to force him to come forward. I don't think that even Bob Kerry would claim to be heroic, you know, that in the situation that he came forward. Clearly, with the Winter Soldier testimony, a lot of these guys 30 years ago, when they had no power, they didn't have, you know, huge political credentials, and they came forward and they testified and said they had committed atrocities, and it took a lot of courage for people to do that, and people said, well, why didn't Bob Kerry come forward then, and, you know, indeed, why didn't he? But the point is, when he did come forward, it still took some courage to come forward to admit that he had killed women and children. And what you had was certain national journalists in that calling for a mass murder investigation. Some of them were even calling for mass murder indictments against him. And this is what I really found troubling because, I mean, he was really a low-level, a lieutenant, low-level person carrying out policy. The SEALs were often, they were trained as assassins. That was one of the main things they were trained to do. You know, to my mind, if you're going to have debate, you question the people that created the policies. You question whether America should be in the business of training assassins. But to jump on somebody who was a very lower level military officer carrying out policy, to jump on that person, all it does at this point in the game is simply intimidate and threaten other Vietnam veterans and make them feel that if they haven't come forward, and lots of them, believe me, lots of them have not come forward publicly with stories of atrocities that they've seen. They're just never going to come forward because they're going to say, if you're going to slap down a former United States senator and threaten him with murder investigations, there's no way we're ever going to tell our story. And from what I believe, what this country needs is to have all of these people come forward, tell us what really happened there, because we need to know that. For many, they need to talk about it for their own personal healing, but the country also needs to be aware of exactly what was done in that war, which large parts of it still are shrouded in mystery for this country. And I just feel like it's intimidation, you know, to attack Bob Kerry. Instead of saying thank you, we're glad you were able to talk about it and give some space to other veterans to come forward and talk, you're just going to scare other people off. And lots of vets who have never talked about that war will continue to never talk about it. And believe me, that is a very definite phenomenon as well. I talk to people all the time, like wives and kids. Dad will never talk about that war, or my husband will never talk about that war. Many vets have never opened their mouth about that war. Why? Because the country doesn't want to hear it.
Hmm. The government claimed there were fewer psychiatric casualties in Vietnam than in other wars. And also during the war, combat stress was taken out of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual?
Well, that's one of the very strange things, as if there aren't enough strange things about this war already, but it's true. During World War II and the Korean War, in something called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is kind of like the Bible of the psychiatric profession, there actually was a definition of combat stress, and it had been pioneered by the Menningers, who were very famous psychiatrists. That definition was taken out in 1968. There was the book is DSM is the initials, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. The DSM-2 came out in 1968 without a combat stress definition in it. Nobody to this day can say whether it was a conspiracy, an accident, but the fact that there was no such definition in this new DSM really benefited the government because it was able to say, it was able to make that statement, that this, these are the mentally healthiest generation of veterans we've ever had. And, of course, when the guys would say, we've got the flashbacks and the nightmares and the problems adjusting, or problems trusting people, all the classic symptoms of delayed stress, hypervigilance, the government would open the book and say, the VA would open the book and say, well, look, there's nothing in here. You can't be sick because there's nothing in the book that shows what you got. And it was really the veterans themselves, in their own anger, who formed what they call rap groups. Most of the early ones were under the auspices of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, but not all of them. And people like Shad Meshad, who later became one of the pioneers, he had been a psych officer in Vietnam, actually blown up himself in a helicopter, started little rap groups just off the Venice Pier in Los Angeles, because so many homeless vets were living on or under the old abandoned Venice Pier. So these rap groups were vets getting together, telling each other their own stories. Well, you know, never mind the VA says I'm fine, but hey, I my life is totally screwed up. I can't work, I can't sleep. Another vet, you know, next one in the circle would say, yeah, I got the same problems and I can't do this. And the vets began to shape their own definitions, and eventually they brought in a few psychologists, psychiatrists to help them. Among the more notable was Robert J. Lifton, mm-hmm. who I guess today is probably one of the most famous living psychiatrists, but at that point he was just somebody. He had done a book on Hiroshima, and Lifton was interested in the survivors of trauma and how they came back into the world. And Lifton and another guy named Dr. Chaim Shatan, they would sit in on these rap groups and give the guys some pointers, and not to overwhelm the guys, but just a little bit of guidance. And eventually they shaped a new definition of a psychological malady, which they began calling post-traumatic stress disorder. And after much work and lobbying and convincing of people, there was a lot of resistance to it. It was finally put into the DSM-3 in 1979, I'm sorry. And it has opened up a whole new field of psychiatric work. In the last 20 years or so, there's just been an enormous body, maybe thousands of books and articles on post-traumatic stress disorder, which, you know, 25 years ago didn't exist, if you ask the American Psychiatric Association. And it's helped lots of people besides veterans, because what we know today is that someone who's experienced a rape or has been the victim of a violent crime or who's been in a natural disaster like a tornado or a flood and seen lots of people die right in front of them, that all of those people tend to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. So this area of psychology, which the Vietnam vets have pioneered, is really helping lots of people around the world, men and women and non-soldiers.
Let's talk with another listener. This one in McNabb on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Yes, it's good to talk to you. Two things that I constantly come across whenever I read on Vietnam are fragging, and if you could sort of present to us what that your opinion of that, and Mr. Colin Powell's role in the My Lai massacre cover-up. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll start with the second first. I don't really know Colin Powell's role in the My Lai massacre cover-up. I have heard suggestions that he was involved. Certainly, there were a lot of high-level officers that did know about what had happened in My Lai. And I do not know enough, and I'm not going to, you know, say something that I don't know. I do know this, that the people in helicopters were flying over My Lai. It was photographed. There was a high level, at a high officer level in the American military, there was knowledge for over a year of My Lai. It was definitely covered up. And one thing that I will point out, which I do know about, is that there was a man named Hugh Thompson, who was, I guess, a low-level officer, lieutenant or something, was flying over in one of those helicopters, saw what was going on, landed the helicopter right in the midst of things, saw Callie with a bunch of women and children lined up in a ditch that he was about to kill. And Hugh Thompson had his own gunners, his own machine gunners in his own helicopter, train their guns on Callie and his men and say, do not kill those Vietnamese in that ditch. If you do, we will kill you. If you try to kill them, we will kill you. And Callie and his boys backed off, and Hugh Thompson was able to save at least a few Vietnamese people. And the interesting thing about that, the sad thing about that, is that he, of course, should have been given a medal right away. I mean, if there was any heroism in My Lai, it was this man, Hugh Thompson, who had saved some lives, had stopped the slaughter, stopped at least a small part of the slaughter that he could stop. And the government did not give him a medal because they knew that if they gave him a medal, they would be admitting to the slaughter, would be admitting to the killing. And it took 30 years of lobbying. I believe he got a medal, I think it was 1998. 30 years later, the American military finally gave this man, Hugh Thompson, a medal. By the way, I think he's been nominated now for a Nobel Peace Prize for what he did. But again, this is a part of the disgrace. It shouldn't have taken them 30 years to give that man a medal. As far as fragging, you bring up a very important area called the GI resistance. Within the military itself, you know, my book is basically about the veterans, the guys who got out and challenged the war, challenged the government. But there was actually a movement of guys on active duty, guys who were still wearing the uniform, in many cases guys who were still in Vietnam, who were resisting orders. There were many mutinies toward the end of the war. Whole units were refusing to go out on patrol, refusing to go into battle. The discipline was breaking down entirely because of Vietnam, because the soldiers were realizing that this war was just a crazy war that they shouldn't be asked to fight. And one of the more severe, probably the most severe aspect of that was the thing called fragging, and that is use of a fragmentation grenade, oftentimes at night, an officer who would be someone who would be insisting that his men go out on suicidal missions, and the guys were getting tired of, you know, the story of that war. They would retake the same piece of ground 10 times. They'd retake a hill, they'd take a hill, and then they'd, at great loss of life and limb. And then a week or two later, this is Hamburger, I don't know if they show that in the movie Hamburger Hill, I don't think they do, but that hill called Hamburger Hill, after they took the thing, after a huge loss of life, they gave it back a week later. And then they went and fought for it, you know, months later again. And guys were just getting tired. It was just like, why? Why this insane loss of life to, you know, to capture and then to give a piece of land back and then go and try to capture it again? And so the only way to stop it sometimes, guys would put a fragmentation grenade under their commander's cot at night and simply kill him. And there was no way to trace them, because if you kill somebody with a bullet, the bullet is traceable. But a fragmentation grenade, that's where the word fragging comes from. It's, you know, just little pieces of metal. There's no way to trace who actually did it. And that happened quite frequently toward the end of the war, unfortunately.
Hmm. We're here at the end of the time that we have to spend together today. Before we go, I want to ask you, what do you think the legacy of the veterans movement has been, will be?
Well, I think two things, two really, many, many, but two very important things. One is the showing the power of a grassroots movement to affect social change, to affect the help, to give help to people. These guys had the country turned its back on them, the government turned its back on them. They were suffering, they were dying, dying from PTSD, from drug problems, dying from Agent Orange. Nobody was helping them, and most of them had nothing. I mean, these were guys, the war was fought by working class people, and so they came back and they had no jobs. It was a time of high unemployment. People that had, you know, 5 cents in their pocket found that by banding together, by using their credibility as soldiers who had fought, that they could really make the nation pay attention to them, get change, get compensation, get recognition for these injuries. One of the things I don't go into in my book, but the Vietnam Veterans Movement had a lot to do with the normalization with Vietnam, of relations with Vietnam. We kept Vietnam on the enemies list for 20 years. Because we lost the war, we were sore losers, and Vietnam veterans began making trips over there, building health clinics, even when it was illegal to do so, when it was trading with the enemy, and really pushed this government to open the doors to Vietnam, again, done by ordinary soldiers with not a lot of money or power. That's one legacy, the self-help movement. The other is, I think, a legacy of conscience, because if anybody in the nation is supposed to do exactly what they're told, it's a soldier is not supposed to speak back to anyone. And these people showed that, you know, the power of free speech, it doesn't just apply to civilians, that no matter who you are, even if you're a soldier, when you're supposed to be bound to do something, you're supposed to be bound to only say what your commanders tell you, that if you feel that your conscience is pushing you to a certain point, to negate what's being done by the country, then you have to speak up. And they really asserted that, you know, kind of what Thoreau wrote about in Civil Disobedience, the power of individual conscience, and that's a great legacy.
Hmm. Gerald Nicosia, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
You're welcome. I was glad to be here.
Gerald Nicosia is the author of the new book, Home to War, A History of the Vietnam Veterans Movement. The book is published by Crown.